Thank you. So I should stress one word in the title, which is given. So I'm going to talk about taking random submatrices of one of a given matrix, and my results are going to be for any given matrix. It's not for a random matrix. The big matrix is not random. What you do is randomly pick out submatrices of that. I really want to start first without matrices, with a little more general setup, show you a more general, different example, and then go to matrices and arrays. So in general, the talk is about, suppose you're given a graph, matrix, or optimization problem. In fact, we'll start with linear programming. We want to get an estimate of the solution of the big problem. From the practical point of view, perhaps the big problem is too big to solve. We want to get an estimate of the solution value by looking at a random small subproblem. Okay? And I'll tell you what that means. It means a natural thing. And the answer will be yes in several cases. But there's one important qualification that it would be nice to extend. At the moment, we seem to be able to do this only for very small random subproblems that you pick out of a big problem. So we don't have good results where the big problem of size n, where n is going to infinity, and you're picking a constant times n subproblem from it, for instance. So this is all being general. Let me illustrate with a simple example of linear programming. So this example is relatively simple. It turns out it'll be useful for some of our matrix results, but it illustrates generally what the setup is. Okay, so here you have a linear program. Most importantly, the variables are constrained to be between 0 and 1, and that's crucial for this, for anything like this to hold. And so I'm just considering feasibility. I have a bunch of linear constraints subject to variables between 0 and 1. Now, I pick a random subset of the variables, Q, and generally I'll let Q denote the random subset. It has little q variables in it. You ought to think of little q as being much smaller than n. Typically, little q is constant and n is going to infinity. And then I write down the linear program on those variables, except it's natural it'll turn out, and it's a right scaling is to scale the right-hand side vector by q over n, and I still want the variables to be between 0 and 1. And the question is, can I say something about the feasibility or infeasibility of this from the feasibility or infeasibility of this? Okay. And later also we can ask the question for optimal values. And the answer is yes, with some error. Really, this is not a difficult result, but I must say I haven't seen it before, so it's probably good to state it. And this is used in some of the proofs of other theorems that I will show you later. The one part that's simple and trivial in all of these results that will be the case is that if LP1 is feasible, if the big linear program is feasible, then indeed the random sublinear program is nearly feasible. Again, everything is with errors. And in fact, if you take the feasible solution to the big linear program that satisfies all those constraints, and then just take the Q part of that solution, well, just by random sampling here, each inequality, the left-hand side, is a sum of n numbers there, and you're picking Q out of them at random, so you're likely to estimate it reasonably well. And I'll put down the errors in another slide. So that part is true. Now, interestingly, almost a similar converse also holds. That's also quite easy, but it requires a little more than this argument. It requires duality. And here, this argument I can show you. It's only so many lines. And this is how it goes. So let's suppose the big linear program is infeasible. There is no solution to the big linear program. Then linear programming duality tells us there is one. There's a non-negative combination which gives you one inequality. It's infeasible, which is infeasible. Right? So there's a non-negative combination. Sorry? There's a non-negative combination so that's infeasible. Now, this is just one inequality. What does it mean to be infeasible over 0 ones? If you think about it, that just means I take all the negative numbers among these and make those x as 1, take the positives, make those x's zero. That's the best I can do, and that must be infeasible. Okay. Now, this is the sum of n real numbers, and that's greater than some number. And here, I'm picking q of those n numbers at random. Okay. And again, it's q picked out of n at random and some random estimation. By just estimation, this should be a reasonable estimate of that. And indeed, therefore, you can derive this with a suitable epsilon. And then this step can be reversed. So in fact, this means that a linear program on the q variables is infeasible. Okay, let me, for this result, I will state it quantitatively, which puts down what the epsilons are and so on and so forth. Right. So that's a big linear program. Q is a random subset. And I'm considering this linear program. The easy part says if the original one is feasible, then this is feasible where I increased every right-hand side by 4 times root q times a infinity. A infinity is the maximum absolute value of an entry in A. So roughly, this is root q times the maximum of one of those entries, right? That's just a standard sampling. And actually, the same thing holds for the infeasibility, but now I have to tighten the right-hand sides. I have to bring in the right-hand sides of it. And you can, by similar reasoning, you can prove results for the optimal solution value. In fact, it turns out the optimal solution value of this tells you something about the optimal solution value of that. Okay? Sorry? This is for every little q, right? Well, let me qualify that. If little q gets very large, then these results are not quite true. I mean, then, you know, I'm applying Hurfting somewhere there. So this, you really have to think of q as a constant. Okay? So I should qualify the whole talk by, as I said in the beginning, it would be awfully nice to derive results when q, for instance, is linear in m. But we don't have such results. Those would be nice. And the reason they would be nice is you can imagine in practice this error is too much if q is really small. In practice, you might have a very large linear program, but you can solve a tenth of the size of the linear program. And you'd like to say, if I pick one-tenth of the variables at random, I get such a good estimate. And that kind of result we don't have in general.
Would it be reasonable to expect that the error goes down as q grows, or...?
Well, it does in... I mean, this really has to be divided by q in some sense, right? So it does in some... So if I take q over n out, which is a scaling factor, there is a 1 over root q here. Right.
And the norm just means the
maximum absolute value of all the entries. That's all I mean. Sorry about my norm notation, which is not what you're used to, and maybe I'll say a few words about that as we go along, because we'll see several norms. Okay. Now, that is for linear programs. Now, I want to consider something more complicated. The next thing I want to consider is combinatorial problems of a certain type, but here's a good example. I have a Boolean satisfiability problem. So I have Boolean clauses in conjunctive normal form. So each clause is a R of variables and their negations, but with a restriction that there are only R variables, R literals per clause. Okay? And R is fixed, small, like 3. Okay? And n goes to infinity. And the answer to the problem, what we want to do is maximize the number of clauses that can be simultaneously satisfied. So in the satisfiability problem you might have heard of, generally you want to satisfy all of them, but perhaps you cannot, then here you want to maximize the number that are satisfied. Okay, and a theorem like what I stated for linear programming also holds for this, and this is a joint result with Noga alone, Lalo Di Da Vega, and Marek Karpinski. And it says the following. So you have an n-variable problem. Yeah, q is 1 over epsilon to the 4. Epsilon is a positive real. Okay, it is to be thought of as a constant positive real. The star just hides log in 1 over epsilon factors. Okay. So there exists a q which is this small, so that if I pick a random subset of variables, q variables at random, okay. And now look at the induced formula on Q. That is, I'm going to take only the clauses which have literals which are in the randomly picked set. I'm going to take only those clauses. And look at how many of them I can satisfy. Then, with high probability, the answer to the whole problem, see, this was an n variable problem, at most r literals per clause, so there could be at most n to the r such clauses. And here's a q variable problem, and the right scaling turns out to be this. And you get that the answers don't differ very much. Okay? Now, this is not a fantastic approximation in some sense. It's only interesting if max f is order n to the r. Otherwise, this error is too much. Sorry? R is the arity, or it's a fixed. R is the number of literals per clause.
So this is somewhat not very surprising. Yeah? Like in regularity lemma, you know that dense cases you can...
So the fact that you can prove it with this error is what you would expect from something like the dense cases. It is, in fact, sort of related to those things, and I'll come to that in a minute. What's a little bit tricky is the following. Just as in the linear programming situation, it's easy to show that if I can satisfy a certain number of clauses here, I can satisfy at least as many here with scaling. I can take the same solution, get it down. What's not so obvious is it might be that in the whole problem I can satisfy very few clauses, but in every random part I can satisfy a lot, but there's no simple way to put the solutions together. And that is the problem.
How all this is related to property-based
inquiry? No, I'm not going to talk about that. In some sense, it is in the framework of property testing. In the case of property testing, usually people consider only R equals 2. The problems with just arity 2, but here it works for all arities. What I was going to concentrate more on is what this has to do with anything that you're all interested in. And in fact, it does. It really has to do with matrices and arrays and approximating them. So I won't... Oh, I see. Good. So I should say, in fact, the theorem holds for all a broader class of problems called max R constraint satisfaction problems, which I won't define, but max R sat is a typical example of that. And the point is, the proofs are not combinatorial. In property testing, most of the proofs are combinatorial, and the difference here is that the proofs are linear algebraic, and they really involve, as I will talk a little more about, involve looking at random subarrays of an R-dimensional array. Okay? And that's what I want to tell you a little bit about here. So you have an R-dimensional array. R-dimensional array just means that two-dimensional arrays are matrices. You have a finite set V, and A is a function from B to the R to the reals. Each value is an entry of A, if you will. I want to define a norm, which I call the cut norm, let's say. This is a norm that was introduced by Alan Friess and me a while back in these contexts, really.
But actually, what is this n-dimensional array? Just function of R variables?
It's just for each point in V to the R, it assigns a real number.
Okay, so
it's just a matrix. I mean, it's an R-dimensional matrix.
V is not a subspace.
V is not a subspace. It's a finite set. V is a finite set. Sorry. V is more like a set of vertices rather than a subspace. V comes from that. Okay. And the norm is... I'm going to take the maximum. This is really the maximum. Maximum over all subsets of V. And for each subset, I take the sum of all the entries. Where, you know, I belongs to S1, J belongs to S2, etc. So I take a rectangular solid and take the sum of all entries in that rectangular solid, and I take the maximum over all that. That's my norm. And as I remarked here, this is not important for this talk, but it is the case that this is within a factor of constant factors, factor of 2 to the R of L infinity to the R minus 1 to L1 norm, if you view A as an operator from L infinity to R minus 1 to L1. Again, that's not important because it's probably nice, intuitively simple to think about the norm as just this. So I take all subrectangles and take the sum and take the maximum absolute value 1. Okay. And as I said, what's involved in the proof of that is several things about such arrays, but there's one thing I can state simply and I want to remark a little bit on the proof. So suppose you have such an array. The star in this place denotes footnote. It doesn't hide any factors. Okay. So I have such an array with maximum absolute value entries at most 1 over epsilon. And this, again, so my subscript for norms are more like numerical analysis subscripts. This is the Frobenius norm, which is the sum of squares of all the entries. Okay. So sub f denotes the sum of squares of all the entries of the array. So that is v to the r. So roughly what this saying, this condition is saying, that each entry is about order 1 in absolute value, if on the average. But some entries can be quite big. Okay. Now, what I would like to do is, so I take a random subset, Q, of this V, and then I look at the induced subarray on Q to the R. So I look at that part of A which is induced by Q, and I would like to say the operator norm of B is small provided the same is true for A. So that's what I want to do. So I want to bound the cut norm of B in terms of the cut norm of A. Okay. Again, the right scaling factor is Q to the R over V to the R, and there is a little error of epsilon Q to the R. Perhaps a typical example is good to illustrate here. So if every entry, let's say, is order 1 in absolute value, that satisfies the hypothesis. Okay. Then this says that the cut norm of this is at most this property, which is sort of the average over all subsets, plus this error epsilon Q to the R. Well, if each entry is about 1 in absolute value, the cut norm is never more than Q to the R. So this makes an error of epsilon times that at most. It's two-sided. The other side is trivial. So it is true that that's greater than or equal to that 2. But that is the direction, which is the easy direction for linear programming, so I didn't put it down. So this direction would just say that if I take a sets that maximize the norm here, and I take the corresponding sets in Q, they give you a good answer. And that's in fact true. Okay? And the way it's used is, the corollary to this is, if I have a good approximation A prime to A in the cut norm, then in fact that induces a good approximation for almost all subsets Q. So the big array is well approximated by A prime, then so is every induced subarray.
Is this sub f when we put square norm?
Sub f is the sum of squares of all the entries. Hilbert.
It's
there. Yeah, it's there. Okay. So I want to spend a slide on trying to tell you the outline of the proof of this.
Oh. Is it possible that if you allowed yourself different pieces in the different dimensions, you could get away without the infinity condition on them?
I don't believe you can. I mean, I don't know a proof which gets away from the infinity condition. See, the infinity condition somehow says that it gives you the use of things like Hurfting or inequalities like that, where you pick some subset of reals from a whole thing. If some of the reals are wildly big, then you don't really get good results.
You would have a high probability.
Yeah. So, in fact, you raise a good point. That is, you know, suppose I don't pick Q to the R, and I pick Q1, Q2, and so on. Then the result is easier. Then it makes life a lot easier. It makes life quite a bit difficult because of this induced thing.
And this R is exactly R which involves Z. So
that R is exactly the R that...
In fact, it's R over 2 because you did not take square root. And in your mind, you keep R large, small, what is...
R is fixed and small. So R is 3. I mean, 2 would... Oh, by the way, I should say, this is interesting already for R equals 2. For matrices, this is already non-trivial and has... The proofs involve all the complications of the general R proof. Okay, so let me try to... this and the linear programming are the two crucial parts to the proof of the theorem, and let me try to illustrate this part now, but I won't connect them up. So, okay, this is a very vague remark. So
you can ignore it if you like. All I'm saying is we've heard a bunch of talks about random matrices and bounding operator norms of those, but there you do have certain other tools that are not available here. Okay? But as I said, even for R equals 2, this already illustrates basically all the problems. Okay. So let me run through an idea of the proof. So let's denote by A plus this maximum. It's a one-sided. I'm not taking absolute values here. I'm just taking the maximum subsets and this denotes the sum of all the entries. Excuse me. Piece of notation. A, S1, S2 to SR is just this thing. Inside the absolute value. Without the absolute value, no. Okay. Now if I tell you S2 through SR, which attain the maximum, then S1 is found like this, I claim. So suppose J is S2 cross S3 up to SR, then I would take S1 to be precisely this set. Namely, I would take all indices in V for which the sum in that row is positive. Because I want to make the overall sum as high as possible, I'd take only the positives. I wouldn't take the negatives. Okay. So if I tell you all but one, then pos J, which is the notation here, tells you what that one will be. Okay. Now, let's take a random subset V of cardinality epsilon to the fourth, 1 over epsilon to the fourth, and let's suppose Q1 through QR are random subsets, each of Q to the R minus 1, okay, of cardinality 1 over epsilon squared. Then it turns out, this is a lemma that I won't prove, but I want to at least tell you what it is. So it turns out that then we can show that there is a subset of Q1, subset of Q2, and so on. So that if I put those here, I nearly get the maximum. I nearly get B+. Okay. So again, B+ was when I maximized over all subsets the sum of the elements. Okay. And that maximum is nearly attained by some subset of every one of these random sets. That's this lemma. Okay. Again, I won't prove this, but let's just assume this. No. That is just existential. So if you wanted an algorithm, you would have to try out every subset. And indeed, that's an algorithm that's used called exhaustive sampling sometimes. Now let's do something funny, which is wrong, but it turns out to be fixable. So let's suppose here I picked Q, and independently of Q, I picked Q1 through QR. Let me cancel the treatment. That was a Freudian slip, because that's what I want to do in the second part. So here I picked Q, and I picked Q1 through QR dependent on Q. In fact, they were subsets of Q to the R minus 1. Okay. Now, suppose simultaneously I also could assume that Q1 through QR were independent of Q. This is obviously false, but suppose I could simultaneously assume that. Okay. Then let's look at this part. Okay. Now, in the whole matrix, we have these sets. And this Q1 to QR are random subsets of the whole thing. Therefore, this is a good estimate of that. So now I have a whole array, and I'm picking out Q1 through QR, which are just random parts. And therefore, I should have that this is an estimate of that. Okay. And if I had that, then I would be done, because that would say that B plus is... So if you combine these two, you get these things. You get this, and then you have to argue something for B minus, but it's a symmetric argument, and then you will get the answer. Okay. Now, but this is fallacious, of course. I cannot... Here I had to pick Q1 through QR subsets of Q. Here I had to assume Q1 through QR were independent of Q. But in fact, that can be made to... Sorry?
Just, you know, in the spirit of analogy, we are looking... But this theorem, from one side, recall us something. Reduction of diameter, what it is, supremum, and so on. But in what analogy I have in my mind, it should be some stabilization. It cannot continue all time. And I want to see this stabilization. And perhaps it is
The error, if you do it, the stability is because of the error, and you can't keep doing smaller. You can't repeat it. So, well, let's see. Now, so, there were two roles played by Q1, Q1 through QR, which were contradictory, but it turns out we can make them work. And this is an argument which is sort of reminiscent of the Wapnick-Chervonenkis theorem proof, where you pick random samples, and there are two ways of looking at it, and you use both to get the result. And that's really what happens. So it turns out, in fact, I can look upon Q1 through QR as subsets of Q to the R minus 1 as well. I can have them be simultaneously independent by a trick. Okay, and maybe that's all I'll say about this, but that makes the whole thing go through. Okay, at this point, I hadn't planned to talk about the regularity lemma, but people told me that there was some discussion, so I thought maybe I will I made up two slides on older results using this, so maybe I should show them somewhat quickly. So I'm going to state these only for matrices, two-dimensional arrays, R equals 2, but really they extend to all R. Let's see. So let's define a cut matrix. So now we have a matrix on V squared, okay? And then we define a cut matrix which is specified by a set of rows, subset of rows, subset of columns, and a real number. And the idea is in those rows and columns, you put that real number as the entry. In other places, you put zero, okay? And so it's a matrix of rank 1, a very special matrix of rank 1. And here's a observation. This is from a paper with Alan Fries that I had a while back, all of the next two slides. And the observation is that if you had any m by n matrix with absolute value at most 1 in each entry, and epsilon is a positive real, you can always approximate it well by a sum of small number of cut matrices. So you take 1 over epsilon squared cut matrices, then you can make the approximation good in cut norm at most epsilon times mn. So the cut norm of the whole matrix is at most m times n. This cuts it down by an epsilon. This is easy. Okay? And this also extends to the R-dimensional arrays. Now, what we do is apply this to the adjacency matrix of a graph. And then we get... So, and then we take the adjacency matrix, we can find a sum of cut matrices D, which is a good approximation. That is, the error is at most epsilon n squared in cut norm, just from that. Now I take two subsets of vertices, and I want to know the number of edges with one endpoint in S, another endpoint in T. I want to get a hold of that number for every subset S and T. So let AST be the AST is the number of edges from S to T. Now DST, I take the sum of entries of the D matrix, we know should be AST plus or minus epsilon n squared. Okay. And now it turns out by appealing to the special form of D, which I won't go into, we get a version of Zemeretti's regularity lemma here, which I've stated precisely. It's not too difficult to go from there to here, but I won't say that. But let me tell you what this is. So this is saying I have a graph with vertex set V. I can partition it into this many pieces, 2 to the 1 over epsilon squared parts. And with every pair of parts, I associate a real number, mu ij. With parts I and j, with a pair, associate a real number. And I want to get a hold of AST, the number of edges from S to T. And what this is saying is this. I take the part of S in PI. I take the part of T in PJ. And pretend that the density between them is mu ij. Mu ij is some real number between 0 and 1. So there are this many vertices at this end, that many vertices at that end. I pretend the density is mu ij. If it was exactly mu ij, this is how many edges I would get from S to T. Okay. But this is how many I have. And the statement is that the difference is at most epsilon n squared, which follows from that epsilon n squared. Okay. So if you are familiar with Zemeretti's regularity lemma, the number of parts here is much smaller, but the conclusion is weaker.
Because you have it for
That's right. So some of everything at once instead of having every pair of parts. And unfortunately, I must say, I spent a little bit of time trying, but not so much. This doesn't seem to give you anything for arithmetic progressions. It's to be expected, but okay. But anyway, it does give you that does give you some algorithmic consequences, which we had stated in our paper of a while back.
How tight is the one in the
square? So, in the last paper with Alon de la Vega and Karpinski, we proved that the number of cut matrices you need is omega 1 over epsilon squared. So it doesn't say, it doesn't yet do this, but I believe this should be tight. I don't have a proof, but that's my hunch that 2 to the 1 over epsilon squared should be tight for the number of parts you split into. So how many minutes do I have? 15 minutes, good. So I'm going to now switch gears a little bit and talk about something more practical for matrices, just for two-dimensional arrays. And the idea here is, it's again random submatrices, but as I said, the consideration here is more practical. The question is, how well can we approximate an M by N matrix by when we are given only, not the whole matrix, but we are only taking a random subset of a small number of rows and a random subset of a small number of columns of A. Okay? And, okay, now, this is the operator norm now, so I put sub 2 for that. Okay? And we would like to say, we would like to approximate by an A prime so that the error in some norm, we'll have to worry about what's the right norms here, only among these two, is smaller than epsilon times the norm of A. Again, we have to put the right norm there. So, first off, before stating the theorem, I want to just go over what's possible and not a little bit. So, if I picked rows and columns uniformly at random, I shouldn't get anything of this sort. The reason is, I could have a matrix. I want these things to work for every matrix. I could have a matrix which has, for instance, only one entry, which is 1, everybody else 0. And if I pick uniformly at random a small number of rows and columns, S is constant, number of rows and columns, I'd only see zeros, all zeros. And if you only see zeros, it's easy to convince yourself the best approximation you can produce is all zeros. And that will not satisfy this condition, whatever norms you put there. So it wouldn't do to sample uniformly. However, there is a classical device that helps us do this, but that's not what I want to do, but I want to state that. So singular value decomposition. So this is a rectangular matrix. You can always decompose it right into the R is the rank of A, sigma T are non-negative, positive, let's say, reals. This is a rank 1 matrix vector, right? So if I was able to find this, if I spent the time to find this and took the top few terms, that would provide a good approximation. Okay? But that's not what I want to do. I want to just take the top a few rows and few columns and from that arrive at an approximation. And so this is a theorem jointly obtained with Petros Rinaeus, who's a PhD student working with me. And so here's a statement of the theorem, and then I'll try to explain it. So let C be a matrix consisting of S columns of A. So it's an M by S matrix. R is a matrix consisting of S rows of A. And the columns first are picked in S IID trials. In each trial, you pick a column with probability proportional to its length squared. So in trial 1, you pick one of the N columns. The probability that you pick the ith is the length squared, which is sum of squares of all the entries, of the ith 1 divided by the sum of squares of all the entries. It turns out these probabilities are the best in a certain sense, and as I said, uniform sampling won't do, but this will do, as I will state the theorem. So if I do that, and maybe a picture would be useful here. So the picture looks like this, right? I'm going to have A. C consists of some number of columns of it. It's a tall, skinny matrix.
or consists of some number of rules of A, provided they are picked with these probabilities, I can then compute an S bias matrix U from them to put in the middle so that the following things are true. The expected value of the operator norm of the error, so CUR is going to be my approximation to A. So the error has this much error. Now let's look at this for a bit. This business depends on the sum of squares of all the entries, but goes down with S as 1 over root S. And this now is the root S plus 1 singular value of A. And before I state the next one, let's compare this to the SVD, to standard linear algebra. So if you did SVD, which takes a lot more time, so here I'm only picking S rows and S columns, and U is computed just from those. If you did the whole SVD, then you would get an M by S and S by N matrix. And if you subtract them out, what will be left is, this should be S plus 1, excuse me. So what's left is the S plus 1 singular value onwards. Okay, and the operator norm of that is just sigma S plus 1 squared. Now I do something cheaper, but I suffer a little bit. So instead of S here, I get root S plus 1, which is bigger, and I get this extra term. Okay, and also you can, this is the expectation. Okay, this is a random process, this is the expectation. So the expected value of the Frobenius norm squared error, there is this term now, which is S to the 1/4, also goes to 0 as S goes to infinity, but depends on the sum of squares of all the entries. And in the case of standard linear algebra, you would get, if you remove the top S components, what's left is S plus 1 onwards, right? And here what's left is root S plus 1 onwards. Sorry? Well, no, I have the whole column, so I can get the column length. So you need the column length in the middle of the computation, right? Sorry?
Is the last one? Right,
and the coefficient is the last one. This one. Oh, I should have said SVT. Yes, you're right. Sorry. So that's linear algebra, right? SVT. That's a full linear algebra. Okay. I won't actually tell you the proof of this. Unfortunately, the proof is not, I mean, it's sort of clear what you should be and so on, but it seems to be a lot of sweat to prove that. I mean, it requires some work. Okay, so picture looks like this. Now one can ask, for instance, here I put Frobenius norm here and operator norm there. Unfortunately, the better thing would have been something like this, but this is impossible because if you just take the identity matrix, which is an essentially high rank matrix. So I should say, these things are only good for matrices that are essentially low rank plus some noise, which is the thing that happens in a lot of practical applications. There's an area called principal component analysis, which is used in economics and statistics, where in fact you do have matrices which are big, M and N are big, but they're essentially low rank plus a little bit. And it's for those matrices that this is useful. So the identity is essentially high rank, and you cannot get this, right, for the identity, obviously. And again, for the identity, you cannot get this with S constant. So unfortunately, you cannot do better than having the two norm on this side, the Frobenius norm on that side, in the first inequality.
Do you think the dependencies on S are
optimal? The dependencies on S, I hope, are not optimal. I think they are not optimal. So there's potentially a better way to do this. There are several Cauchy-Schwarzes which do this S to the 1/4 to you at the end of the day. So should be avoidable, some of them, hopefully. Also, it'll be nice to prove this for other norms. I mean, so these are, I mean, at the heart of this, they use things like Hoffman-Wieland and perturbation results, which are available for other norms. So potentially we can also do that. But that's, again, not done. Now, I want to say something about the practical computation of this. The idea here is, you know, clearly you can do full linear algebra if you have time. So this is only useful
if it saves a lot of time. And in fact, it saves time and also space. So let's go through this. First off, there's a sampling primitive which will be useful for us to remember. That's very simple, this part. If I have a bunch of n real numbers given to me, but they are flying past me, I see one and then I lose it, and I see the next one, then I lose it. That's all. I cannot write them all down. But it turns out I can still draw a sample AI with probabilities proportional to the squares. So that's not very difficult to show, okay, without extra storage. So using that primitive, we can actually pick rows and columns that we want for the theorem according to the correct probabilities after having looked at the matrix once as it's flying past us. So the idea here is the matrix is huge. It's stored not in main memory but in core, and you can read the core sequentially once, and quickly you must glean an approximation and store it into RAM. That's what C, U, and R will be, where they'll be stored. So you can in fact pick out which rows and columns you're interested in. You're going to sample in the first pass. You need another pass though, so you need to reread the whole matrix to pick out the entire C and R. And once you do that, you can do the whole computation in RAM, and now you only take that much space. How many minutes do I have? Four. Oh, that's excellent. Okay. So in two passes through the whole matrix and this much additional space, you can compute the approximation CUR and store it in RAM. And then further on, later on, if you want to do computations with A, you can just use this approximation. So there is another method to do such approximations due to Acuptis and McSherry, which I want to mention. It's different. So here, in this method, you have a matrix A again, and I would like to approximate it again. I approximate it by an A hat, which is still M by N, but is a lot sparser. And because it's sparse, it's easier to compute with. And the idea is, for every ij, I make that entry 0 with probability 1 minus alpha, and then I make it 1 over alpha times aij with probability alpha. So the expected value of a hat is a, but it has a lot of zeros. Okay. Now, a minus a hat then is a random, is a matrix with random independent entries. It's a really random matrix. And therefore, we can bound its norm by classical theorems, which we've heard a lot about. And so so this kind of sampling, I'll call it unweighted sampling. It gives you some error bounds, provided you can assume that each entry of A is at most a certain amount in absolute value. Okay? Now, if the entries are very disparate, some entries are much bigger than others, then you would do weighted sampling. So we can, in fact, their method can be extended to the weighted case where we can pick entries to put in there with probabilities that are proportional to the square. But the trouble is that this has a fairly high variance, right? I mean, if I want a sparse matrix, I want alpha small. Let's say alpha is 1 over 100. I'm setting it to 0 with probability 99 hundredths. I'm setting it to 100 times this with probability 1 over 100. That has high variance. So the cost you pay for this is the variance is a bit high. But then they're able to show that if I take my A hat and find an A hat, which is sparser and a bit cheaper, I do full linear algebra, then I do get an approximation here. The comparison with our stuff is this term is bad for the Frobenius norm. The two norm, their bound is actually quite good. So that's all I'll say, except I want to mention again that one open question I said in the beginning. From a practical point of view, or just out of interest, it would be nice to prove nice results like this where you pick very large chunks, random chunks, out of the matrix. So, for example, if you have an array where V is cardinality N, you pick Q to be order M. And in this context, it makes a difference. You have to sample without replacement, of course. And that makes a difference for us, actually, with and without replacement are the same, because Q is small. And it'd be nice to get results for such that range of Q, and we don't know anything like that. So I'll stop here.
Questions?
Yes.
What's involved in computing this U given C?
It's linear algebra. It's SVD on an S by S matrix. So SVD on a fairly small matrix. So it's really not too much work.
More questions?
Thank you.
The next talk we're going to have on our Q&A.